I will be starting my interview with Eileen English and talking about her memoir, Hippie Chick, Coming of Age in the 60s. So it should be interesting. Certainly, I was of that time, so obviously we all had little different experiences of those times. But why don't you just say hello, Eileen, whilst we...
Hello, welcome.
That'll be fun, casting our minds back. Thank goodness we still can to those times.
Arnold, did you have a chance to read the book?
I did read the book.
Oh.
So whatever I've retained is as best I can do. So,
okay. Well, it's not out yet, so you have an advanced copy.
The way you've done the chapter flow, so that gives me some good reminders from my notes and things.
Great.
So,
good.
So we'll be there. So welcome back, everybody. And I would like to welcome Eileen English in the studio.
Thank you.
Hi, Eileen. And she is the author of a new memoir coming out called Hippie Chick, Coming of Age in the 60s.
I'm still coming of age.
Yeah.
I haven't gotten there yet.
A lot of us who came of age in those years have definitely either kept going with it or never left and or kept a lot of it in our hearts, at least.
I've noticed. What do you think that is?
Because it was good. It was right. It felt good to us. It was the right approach,
mm-hmm.
Would be my quicker answer, I think. If it was right in our hearts, that's why we gravitated.
It was a very hopeful time.
Yeah.
A very exciting time.
I was in England in the 60s, so America had the Vietnam War, which crystallized things in many other ways over here as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was a tension between the hippies who were celebrating and all about freedom and free love, and then in Berkeley they were demonstrating the war and civil rights, and they were two different communities for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that eternal picture of a hippie putting a rose in the rifle barrel of the
exactly.
National Guard is a classic.
Yeah.
And also on the cover of your book, that's a classic photo of somebody dancing in Golden Gate Park at a B-in, I'm assuming.
Yes. I have had so many people ask me if that was me, if that's me on the cover. It's me energetically.
Okay.
That's what Tui told me to say.
Okay. Hi, Tui. Yeah, exactly. I think I remember that from some films I've seen. She looks very familiar.
I'm not sure who she is. She'll probably find herself on that cover and call me. I don't know.
Nowadays, it's easy to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Eileen, yes. All those years ago, 50 years ago.
Thanks for reminding
and,
me.
But it, as I said, it's an important place that made us who we are today. So
absolutely,
that's the strength of that. And with all those years ago, what made you decide to put pen to paper at this moment?
It's a good question. So much of my life was in survival mode for lots of reasons. I didn't really have the slack to reflect back on my life very much. And so when I turned 70, I decided it was now or never. And I just started writing. I had been in writing groups and I had lots of notes and pieces that I had written. So I had a head start on it. But I finally got serious about it. I learned so many things writing the book. I mean, basic stuff like that I was actually loved. Mm. I had, in the ways of a child, I didn't know that. I thought that it was, everything that was wrong was about me, you know? And I began to see my life as a journey. And I gained a lot of compassion for that girl on a road.
That had been very amorphous beforehand,
mm-hmm.
suddenly collected.
Came into focus.
Into something real again.
And, you know, I feel like writing the book has helped me find my voice. And I have hope that maybe I can inspire other young women who are trying to make their way. I also wanted to honor people who made such a difference in my life, to honor my sister, who saved my life over and over again.
Right, Carol.
Carol, yeah.
Indeed, and that's and a lot of threaded through the book is family, mm-hmm. as well. Even though through estrangements and all sorts of different trials and tribulations, mm-hmm. there is that thread there for you.
Yes, yes. I was the baby. There was six of us, and there was a very wide span in age. I had a very sick mother. By the time I came along, she had a bad heart. She had several heart attacks. And she had one of the first open-heart surgeries, the 13th of its kind ever.
Oh, wow.
And in all that, I became something of a lost child because there was really no one who was looking out for me. My siblings had all pretty much left home and gotten married or went off to college. And I became a wild teenager, sneaking out with boys, stealing, lying. Yeah. I didn't take myself seriously, and yeah. I wasn't taken seriously by anyone else either. In fact, I was voted the most mischievous in my high school graduating class.
Oh, my God. There really was such a category.
Yeah.
I love it. Did you get a special ribbon or something?
It stayed with me ever since. I always felt like it was because of my wild Jewish hair that I was so crazy, you know, because that's why people didn't take me seriously. It was kind of clown-like. I spent half my life trying to straighten my hair, but I would just go outside and it would just frizz right up.
Frizz right.
Yeah, I wasn't very successful at that.
I know the feeling, yeah.
Mm. And then in the middle of all that rebellion, I found my mother dead on the toilet.
You actually found her?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I was 16. Mm. So suddenly I was living alone with my father. And my father, because all my other siblings were gone by then, he was a difficult and angry guy. Mm. And even though he had a huge presence in the house, I didn't really have a relationship with him. He was irritable and volatile. And living alone with him was scary.
Mm. Okay.
Plus, he expected me to take over my mother's role of cooking and cleaning for him.
And as a teenage girl, that was not something
okay.
you were thinking of.
Yeah. So that's when my sister, Carol, fortunately stepped in and sent me a plane ticket to California.
Ah.
Yeah.
The savior.
Mm-hmm.
So now this was from New Jersey?
Yes, indeed. And that was 1963.
63,
so
wow.
So quite early. I didn't go to San Francisco looking for hippies. I was the hippie. I was the first misfit in a community of misfits.
That sounds a great start. With Eileen English here and talking about her book, Hippie Chick. She grew up in New Jersey and she flew to California. So how did that all happen? How did that opportunity occur?
Well, my sister sent me a plane ticket. And so I moved in with her and her husband, David. And that was in Tiburon. And I was completely blown away to see Tiburon because it was so beautiful. And the view of San Francisco Bay and all the colors. And it was such a contrast to the... I don't know if I told you that I was raised in the middle of a shopping center. Did I tell you that?
No.
Yeah,
in which aisle?
My father wouldn't let them knock down our house when they were building stores in our neighborhood.
Hello.
And so they built all around us. So for blocks and blocks, there were supermarkets and drug stores and five and dime stores and liquor stores and butchers. And ours was the only house for blocks. So that's where I was raised. So there were no trees. There were no neighbors. It was pretty depressing, actually.
Yeah.
Suddenly, to be in Tiburon and seeing the colors, I'm still struck when I think of the pinks and the oranges of the sunsets and the blues and greens of the water and the sky. I was just stunned at the color. It's interesting, I became a glass artist. I wonder if there's some reason why, but...
Hmm. In your book, you mentioned good old Blackie. I remember him.
Oh, yeah.
When I first came here in the 70s, he was in his meadow there. Now there's the statue of him.
Yeah.
Yeah, so then, so you landed in, almost in outer space, into California, and So how did you acclimatize? With all this, now this, what year was this?
63.
So the whole hippie scene hadn't started yet. It was still really the more beatnik scene in a way in San Francisco.
I think
Francisco
it was kind of
area.
Right in the middle between beatniks and hippies. Mm-hmm. And my sister and brother-in-law owned some real estate in San Francisco, and they were renting an apartment, and the phone rang when I was there, and my sister was going to have to go into the city to show the apartment, and my brother-in-law suggested that maybe Eileen could do it. So they set me up in my sister's unbelievably gorgeous maroon Cadillac convertible with the white top.
Oh,
put the top down. This is my first drive.
As a 16-year-old?
Right. No, I was 17 by then.
Oh, 70. Okay. Yeah.
And I got to drive across the Golden Gate Bridge by myself, blasting the radio. I think I was playing Puff the Magic Dragon at the time, to go meet these three guys who wanted to maybe rent the apartment. And I wound up spending the whole afternoon with them. I was giddy, and it was really fun. They were a lot older than me. And by the end of our afternoon, they asked me if I wanted to move in with them. And I didn't know, but I went back and asked my sister, and she said, well, were they nice guys? And I said, yeah, they were really nice guys. So do you want to? You want to move in with these three guys? I said, I guess so, but I don't have any money. I don't you have a job. My brother-in-law said, well, how about if we pay your share? Mm. So, again, they were constantly encouraging me through, you know, supporting me.
Right.
In many ways over the years, my sister and brother-in-law. And so it turned out that I moved in with these three older guys. Yeah.
In San Fran, right in the middle of San Francisco.
Yes, indeed. My sister knew how much despair I had about my frizzy curly hair, and she brought home from Thailand a hairpiece of long ponytail of human hair for me, and she weaved it into my hair before I went into the city to meet these guys, and they thought I had this long, beautiful hair, and after I moved in with them, I didn't want to take it off. I didn't want them to know that I had this curly, frizzy Jewish hair, and for a long time, I kept the secret, and it was starting to itch, and it was driving me crazy, and yeah, so that's a whole story.
Well, you're taking on a different persona.
I was trying to, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I wasn't really ready to accept who I actually was.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And now, so did that move, you know, obviously you had to mature pretty quickly from living at home back in New Jersey. All of a sudden you were living, you know, in a flat with others and with all the world that brings young people.
Yeah, and these three guys were way into jazz. They had a huge collection of jazz albums, and we used to sit around the living room listening to all the jazz greats, and we'd go out to North Beach on Sundays to listen to it live. I saw all the big jazz musicians live in North Beach at a little club called the Jazz Workshop.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and so I developed a love for jazz.
And yeah, in fact, you did, because of those years. You really hit the cream of the crop in terms of a lot of jazz musicians who came through San Francisco in the early 60s.
Yeah.
That must have been incredible to see them there doing at the top of their craft.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Any favorites?
Do I have favorites?
Any favorites you saw from that time?
Roland Kirk. Oh. Do you know Roland Kirk?
Oh, my goodness. I tried to emulate him with recorders, two recorders at once.
Yeah, he'd have three different horns in his mouth at one time, and he'd also be singing, and he was blind to boot, and he was just amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, no, truly an incredible talent, yeah. Neat. And so, but the jazz scene, now how again, you jumped, that's a pretty heavy scene. How was that, a youngster jumping into something as like that?
Well, there's all kinds of stories, you know, that I could tell right now. I don't know which ones to tell, but I made a friend in San Francisco. Her name was Birgit. Mm. And Birgit had just come to America from Denmark. And she and I became roommates after I moved out. I lived with the three guys for, I don't know how long it was, maybe a year and a half or something. And you'll have to read the book to find out what happens.
Right. But lots of stuff happened, everyone.
So. A lot of stuff happened. And Birgit was so cool. She smoked cigars, and she also was a, loved jazz, and she would only go out with black guys. And I just looked up to her. I thought she was the coolest thing ever. So we started going to jazz clubs and listening to music till all hours. I don't know if I'm going to tell you the stories. You're going to have to read the story about Dizzy Gillespie.
Well, you could, throw a tidbit out.
We were at the jazz workshop. It was 2 a.m. Dizzy Gillespie was just finishing up his gig, and he was playing with Bolasete. You know who he is? Bolasete is a Brazilian guitarist.
Oh, okay.
Dizzy came over to our table and said, do you two want to go get high? So
that's why they called him Dizzy.
We looked at each other and went, sure, why not? You know, we were young and up for most anything. To anyway, read the book to find out what happens. Yes, it was exciting.
San Francisco in those early 60s, for me, that was like a sacred place, reading about it in England, what was happening in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. You were there and experiencing it on, you know, right then. What was it like? What was the flavor, the taste, the smell of that?
Well, I was there early,
yeah.
You know, before it got really crazy. And it was exciting. There was lots of color. I mean, all the posters, all the clothing that we wore, you know, it was kind of like vintage clothing and the psychedelic posters and the music. It was pretty overwhelming. I think I spent a lot of years with my mouth hanging open, like, wow, what is this, you know? It was very exciting, very exciting. What happened is that during the week, it would be a working class neighborhood, the Haight. And on the weekends, all these young kids would come and party and wear costumes. And it started changing. It started changing into something else that I didn't quite understand. And then they would leave. And the next weekend, they would be back again. So it became almost like a Disneyland kind of thing instead of just living our life.
That changed it a lot. And then of course, at that point, what made you leave San Francisco amidst all that? What was the...
It was getting pretty crazy.
Because of that, okay.
And it had lost its feeling of home in some ways. You know, it became a scene, such a big scene. But also, I left because I was running away from a man that I was in love with who turned out to be a heroin addict, and I was just trying to save my own life, really. In those days, we used to have open dated airplane tickets. And my sister had left me one before she moved to Hawaii. So I had this ticket that I could use. And when I needed to flee, I once again did.
And this is Carol, your sister?
Again, Carol, yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. She was like the guardian angel for you there.
She was.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So Hawaii, again, New Jersey, San Francisco, Hawaii.
Right.
You certainly jumped to the extremes.
Indeed. Yeah, Carol and David moved to Hawaii because they lost everything they owned, which is a whole story in itself about a bank that collapsed and all the loans were called and they suddenly became penniless after being quite wealthy. So they started over in Hawaii. Fortunately, invited me to come be wherever they were. And one of the things that we did in Hawaii was we scuba dived. Mm. And I was, again, blown away by the beauty of being able to breathe naturally underwater. And I became certified as a scuba diver, and we used to just hold hands and go diving in the Hawaiian waters before, again, it was early. It was before it was a thing. It was very pure and still undamaged.
Right.
So I feel like I was very fortunate. I got to see a lot of things before they kind of got ruined.
You know, some very tragic things happened in Hawaii as well for you. Can you explain that? Tell us about that.
My sister Carol got sick very soon after I got there. And I spent the next year being there for her. She was actually dying and had a rare disease that they didn't really know how to deal with in those days. And she was pregnant at the same time. So I just spent that year being with her. I think I'm going to leave the rest for you to read about.
That whole process, though, made you again come back to the mainland?
Right. After Carol died, I left. I went back to California. And the scene had really changed and had become more mature in some ways. But psychedelics were really on the rise. And there was this thing called Monday Night Class. And it was Stephen Gaskin. And he was just leading this class about psychedelics and how to use them in ways that respect the sacrament that they were. In those days, it was a brand new thing. It was still legal. And these Monday night classes were about how do you treat this thing. It grew and grew and grew until there was thousands of people that came every Monday night. And it was a scene, a big scene, and it became eventually a community. And eventually folks left in a caravan of school buses and went traveling across the country with Stephen, who was doing speaking gigs at universities that he had been invited to go, and everybody went with him. I desperately wanted to go too, but I had a boyfriend who didn't want to, and I had to make a decision if I was going to go or stay, and I didn't go on the caravan. But I eventually...
You did get there eventually.
Get there eventually. They all settled, bought a piece of land in Tennessee and started the farm.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't just a few school buses went on that thing. There was dozens, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was quite a caravan, to say the least.
There's a picture of it in the book. It's, I don't know how many it is, but I think it's 70 or 80 school buses.
Yeah, and so you were there then. You came pretty soon after it was founded and established. Can you tell people what that was? A lot of people have heard about the farm, but there's a lot of myths and things about it. Can you give us a brief idea of what it was physically like and what life was like there?
Well, there was one ground rule, and that was that Stephen was the spiritual teacher. And so if you wanted to live at the farm, you had to come to Stephen as your teacher. So that was the bottom line. And I loved Stephen, and I felt like I had learned so much from him from Monday night class, and I was happy to come to him as my spiritual teacher. So there was this agreement. Everybody had this agreement about what we were up to and how to get along with each other based on the teachings. They were beautiful teachings. They were basically, Stephen used to say, if you take all the religions of the world and that there's commonalities that go through all of them, that's what the teachings were. With having a strong leader, if there was ever any problems, you know, it would be brought to Stephen and Stephen would figure it out. And so that kept things running smoothly for many, many years until it wasn't.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, they started their own schools and they had a tofu business that they started. They were the first people to bring tofu to this country.
Oh, wow.
And so there was a soy dairy, and when they had soy ice cream, they were complete vegetarians. Huh. They didn't believe in abortion. They had lots of children because of that. They all had 5 and 6 kids.
Right.
And the kid thing just really grew. There was big, they used to call them a kid herd, just big bunch of kids running around together. It was a wonderful way for a kid to grow up. So it was very idealistic. These were city hippies who were trying to learn how to be farmers. And they also had this value of wanting to get along with their neighbors. So they were in the middle of redneck Tennessee. And they had long hair. And yet they learned how to get along. It's a very different story than the Rajneeshis who right. in Oregon kind of took over, if you've ever
oh, yes.
heard that story. Yeah, no, this was a different story. This was a story of getting along with neighbors.
Wow.
And they helped them. They helped their neighbors build barns. They would get 20 or 50 guys to go over and help them build a barn. And so it was very symbiotic. The rednecks taught them how to grow things.
Wow.
So it was
beautiful.
It was really beautiful for the longest time until it wasn't.
Right. How long was your experience there?
You know, I came and went. I came and went just like I was wont to do. I got married at the farm. Stephen married us.
Larry.
Larry, yeah.
I was with. So mm-hmm. there was a lot of parallels and odd meetings with him over various sort of cosmic meetings at different times yeah. and places, wasn't there?
Yes, there was. And, you know, at the time, we used to believe that the universe, and maybe I know people still believe that it's the universe is giving us messages all the time, but we really took it to heart back then that if something magical happened, it meant we're supposed to be together. And that's what happened with me and Larry. And I guess we were supposed to be together because we were. And we created a child together. So that's my daughter, Sarah.
Yeah, wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And so what, and again, from that time, you made another big jump in your life from that cycle, you suddenly went up to Oregon.
Yeah, Larry didn't want to live at the farm. I desperately wanted to. I was so happy there. I felt like I had come home, but he didn't want to, and I was in love with him, so I went where he went. And we wound up in Eugene because that's where he decided he was going to do a PhD program. So it was pretty shocking going from Hawaii to Eugene, Oregon. But I found my way there. I started getting into art and studying glass.
Uh-huh.
And I think Eugene, Oregon is a pretty gray place. About 9 months of the year, it's drizzly and cold. And I think the glass was a great antidote for me to just keep color alive in my life. Uh-huh. And I became a pretty good glass artist. Mm. It was something that was very important to me in a way that I supported myself for many years.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Had that been your first art, going into art in that way?
Well, I had been an art major in Hawaii. I was a weaving major at the University of Hawaii, believe it or not. But Larry was so kind of logical, and he encouraged me to pick an art form that I could actually make some money at. And so that's why it turned out to be stained glass. I made stained glass doors and lampshades and things that I could sell. And in Eugene, there was the Saturday Market, which was an open-air crafts fair, and I was able to sell my work there.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But then you became much more in that place, didn't you?
I did. Yeah. Eventually, I... this was after Larry and I split up.
And what year was that, just to give a...
In 1980,
okay.
I became the assistant manager of the Saturday Market. And then in 82, I think it was, I became the manager. And it was a really big job, and I had no idea that I was capable of doing a big job like that. But I did a good job, and I found out that I have a lot of skills.
Isn't that wonderful when we put ourselves to that challenge, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Even though we'd never even thought we needed that challenge.
Right. I felt that Eugene, Oregon was a very nurturing place for me. I learned a lot of, I gained a lot of skills there.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if it has to do with the rain, because you just have to kind of focus in when it's raining all the time.
That is true. Yeah, after 30 years in San Francisco, I know what that was like. Mm-hmm. The folk. But then you stayed up in the area and got involved in the county fair, which is a whole big
country
thing.
Fair.
The country fair, rather, yeah. Which is a whole big entity to itself.
Yes, yeah. The Oregon Country Fair still is. It just celebrated its 50th anniversary this year, and I was there, of course, and have been there most years. And it just is part of my tribe.
Yeah.
The Oregon Country Fair. And a lot of the vendors who sell there get their start at Saturday markets. So it's a symbiotic kind of relationship
there. Like
a
feeder thing, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's very unusual, the country fair. It's not like a regular fair, is it? It's pretty esoteric, one might say.
One of the things that's unusual is that all the people that sell there and all the people that volunteer, it's a volunteer situation, all get to sleep there.
Okay.
So for 3 days or 5 days, everybody's camping out together. And the customers go home at 7. There's this thing called the sweep. And they hold hands and they just sweep through the fair. And if you don't have a wristband on, you're out. And then the party begins, you know, after all the customers go home. And it's quite a party.
Oh, wonderful.
And it's a community. We create a community there.
Yeah. What time, when is it, when does it occur?
It's always the second weekend in July.
Okay.
And it's just huge at this point. I don't know how many. I think it was 45,000 people this year.
Wow.
Or maybe each day or something. I don't know. Yeah, I think it was 45,000 people.
Nice thing to look out over and say, wow, yeah, we did it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, just as a community. It's a lot to be proud of.
Indeed. And so there you are up there. Then all of a sudden you move back down to the Bay Area again. What brought that that movement from up there? Right.
I had a baby and there was a custody threat.
Oh.
And was very afraid of losing my child. And that's kind of when I decided, I went to a lawyer. And she said, you know, you could lose your kid if you don't get your shit together. And so that's when I really straightened up my act and became an adult. I didn't want to lose my kid.
Yeah.
And Larry moved to California by then. And I stayed, and I was a single mom, and I was working at the Saturday market, which was a really big job.
Yeah.
And it was a lot, being a single parent and having a big job. And at a certain point, I felt like I was ready for having some more support in my life. And the man who I had been with let me know that he wasn't going to marry me because he was sick.
Okay.
And so I asked him to help me get out. I had been there for 14 years. And I,
oh, wow. Yeah.
He did. He helped me move to California. And then Sarah had her dad around to help. And so I had a whole nother reincarnation of my life coming back to California.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so the book basically follows that whole flow. And, you know, after writing the book, how do you feel about it now? As you said, it helped coalesce things. Trepidation, because obviously your life will be an open book now, literally. So...
Yeah, hello. I do. I sometimes ask myself, what was I thinking? It's just my story, you know, and everybody has a story, and I saw no reason to hide any of it. I'm not ashamed of anything that I did. I put one foot in front of the other, and I got to here, and where I am here is having a beautiful life. I went back to school, and I became a therapist, and I have a wonderful partner, and we live in the most beautiful place in the world. You've been there, right?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
By sheer coincidence, we just discovered I'd actually been to her place.
Yes. So whatever, it led me to here, and I'm very happy how it all turned out. I'm a pretty stable and happy person.
Yeah, and so details about the book. When does it officially come out, and where and how and what?
Okay, it's being launched at Copperfields in Sebastopol on the 27th, this next Friday night, a week from tonight at 7 p.m. I will be doing some touring. I'm going to kind of keep it local. I don't feel like flying, so I'm going to drive to Eugene in October. And I'm going to be at a bookstore there, Tsunami Books. I'm going to sell at the Saturday market. I'm going to do some stuff in Seattle and Corte Madera at Book Passage.
Yeah.
So, you know, local touring.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, that sounds very comfortable and fun.
Yeah.
You can get to hang out with old friends as well.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, yeah, this is the book, Hippie Chick, Coming of Age in the 60s, Eileen English. And how will it be available online? And what,
yeah, I encourage people to try to buy it from an indie bookstore, though it is also available on Amazon and at all outlets. I heard today that it's going to be available at the SFO Airport Bookstore. Oh.
Wow.
So,
well done.
How about that? The whole world's going to know about Hippie Chick.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Well, San Francisco, everyone knows that. That's
right.
The whole one of those wonderful romantic connotations, isn't it, of San Francisco?
Absolutely.
You know, one of our favorite performers, and I know a great friend of yours, is Teresa Tadouri.
Absolutely.
And an amazing performer who was on Cows for many years and still is. She has moved to New Mexico, but we run a show every Wednesday, 3 to 4, from there. So you can catch up with her. But Eileen has the amazing joy of having Teresa write and perform a song just for her. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it was my 70th birthday, and she's a dear friend, and it was a complete surprise that she just had written the song that morning and performed it. No one knew that it was going to happen, so we didn't record it. And so later that evening, she did a recording. It's not as perfect as when she sang it the first time, but it's all we have, and it's quite a wonderful song.
And so it is just a live recording, and she has given us permission to to put it on. Thank you, Teresa.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you very, very much, Eileen English,
thank you,
for coming
Arnold.
In. And,
thank you so much.
Oh, it's, my pleasure.
It's been a pleasure.
Oh,
yeah.
Good. And I hope you have many more. Right. Great interviews.
Thank you.
For your book.
This is the first.
Oh, well. My honor.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you. So, well, let's go out with Eileen's song by Teresa Tadouri.
Eileen, in a moment of recreation, God made his ultimate creation. He took a huge heart, a grand soul, a spirit so endearing, and stuffed it all into your little bod. You're a marvel of engineering. Eileen, we're here to celebrate. Us to our common fate in this big house, this great house. Look, your friends are all about, and it's a good thing too, 'cause we'll need them to blow all these candles out, because you're old. Through your veins, you're a whirlwind that nothing can contain. And there were times, dear, life here kicked you in the ass, but you kept going to make glowing pictures out of glass. How about all that music you've been making? You play your marimba, but face it, girl, you ain't no Jamaican. You is Jewish, and what else could you be with that huge heart and that huge brain and all that psychotherapy? Now you're don't take no time to fret, 'cause I lay, life is not through with you yet. You could tour Greece or bungee jump, oh wait a minute, or get a whole new set of dentures, or do whatever fuck you want. Life's still full of adventures, and Eileen, hold on. You've done so splendidly with your dear husband, Don, your friends, and your lovely family. You can kick back, chill out, relax, enjoy the ride, for you've succeeded completely. Stand up and say with pride, I am
Yes, the incredible Teresa Tuturi with a very own song for our guest tonight, Eileen English. Thank you, Eileen.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to hear Teresa's song again.
Indeed, yeah. And just wonderful to hear her.
Yes, indeed.
Greatly missed here. Well, thank you very much for coming into the studio, and good luck with your book.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure, Eileen.
Oh, great.
Me.